away for a long time, as you may recall.
There have been ups and downs in this administration, but as I see it, frankly,
I think you've approached the problems. I think you've hit them hard. You've taken risks. Vietnam is a good example. The economy is an excellent example. And as far as I can see, the thrust is upwards as of now. Yeah.
People just now beginning to see it. Not that we were all that prophetic either, but we had to have a lot of faith in our economic policies. I had to have a lot of confidence in those policies not to panic last November, December, and go the way of controls, which many advocated in the administration. They said, well, the inflation will never be slow, the economy will never get going until the people, until the business community is convinced that inflation is being slowed, et cetera, et cetera. Well, we shall always have inflation with us. It has been slowed. It has not been stopped. It will not be stopped. It has been slowed. The economy is beginning to move upward, not as fast as some would like, but on the other hand, we do not want an explosive rise. Any explosive rise in an economy leads to an explosion by definition. We want steady, the whole watchword of this administration is steady, responsible, maintainable policy of growth, policy toward peace, foreign policy and the rest, avoiding the ups and downs of sudden shifts that make great headlines for the moment and great news for a month or two, or 3 months, or 4 months, or 5 months, but lead to enormous problems later on.
How much controversy or discussion with opposition views were expressed before you went on the economy?
Oh, a great number. I would say that, frankly, the majority of the cabinet was leaning toward wage and price controls. I mean, even wage and price controls. In one form or another, I resisted for two reasons. One, I had been an OPA. I knew that wage price controls, it was hard enough to make them work in wartime. It was impossible for them to work in peacetime. And I also knew from my travels around the world that wage price controls would stifle and kill dynamism of the American free enterprise system, which is the greatest source of our strength in the world in the years ahead. We have to realize now that we are now in a period, we reached a period of equality, the nuclear standoff. So what is the greatest advantage the United States has as we enter the last century? Inflation hasn't come down as fast as we would like, but having steady as you go, sticking to our course lines, we now see an economy looking for the second half of 1970, which will be good, and in 1972, which will be very strong. That's I still stick to today.
So now, the New York Times guys feel the same way. I was talking about good Talkin. Well, the financial guys.
They
feel that too. Now, very quickly, when did you make the basic decision on Vietnam? Vietnamization and troop withdrawal.
Vietnamization was always a nice theory that even was held by during Westmoreland days. The difficulty was that it didn't get the thrust behind it that it needed. And we have to realize that this is traditionally an American way. We made the same mistake in Vietnam, we had made it before this administration made it, and that we made in Korea. We said the rocks won't fight. And so they said about the South Vietnamese, they can't act. That's what they used to say. And so we said, well, let's find out. And so we, instead of just making Vietnamization a nice little theory where Americans would be around to buy it by them, we stretched them right to the end of the traces. In other words, we always, in every announcement of withdrawal that I have made, has gone somewhat beyond what our military recommended, and somewhat beyond what, in the first instance, the South Vietnamese wanted. Although they always agreed. They said, well, we'll come up to the mark. And each time, the South Vietnamese had to come up to the mark. Now, had we not set these high targets, we'd be way behind on our withdrawal schedule where we are. But I made a decision, actually, that our setup, we made it in the spring of 1969 after Laird returned from his trip to Vietnam. And he made recommendations. And then, if you recall, it was in June or July of that year that I met you at Midway. At Midway, we announced the first 25,000. You remember 25,000 or 19,000?
Yeah.
And you can't imagine the agony that you went through in this administration to get that 25,000 troop. I mean, the defense, the military, Pugh, et cetera, et cetera. Although Pugh was very good at it, very good. He has always been a strong advocate of Vietnamization. He said, give us the arms, we'll do the job. But I think the South Vietnamese have had more confidence in themselves than have the Americans.
Yeah.
The American military, just frankly, nobody else can quite do it as well as they can. And they are right. The difference is that we simply cannot continue to do it that way.
Because
we made it then, and from then on we've been on a steady course, going. While we had certain numbers in mind, I never tied down myself to anything or allowed the people in the Pentagon or out there to get tied down to any specific numbers. I always kept it flexible, having in mind the fact that the situation might change. So we moved up to 25,000, then 40,000, then 50,000, then 150,000, then another 100,000.
I heard you the other day. Do you think, as I see it now, the issue is... Let me put it this way to you, Mr. President. You always were lucky.
Never has an administration or a president.
this subject?
Well, they're afraid it might win.
Why is that? Not the quote.
That's sure. Oh, there are several reasons. One, you see, it's a raw record.
Off the record, yeah.
They cannot bear the thought that they brought it all along. And I really did it when I said that they cannot bear the thought, too, which you were here, they always gloss over, that it was Kennedy that was involved in the murder of the young. It was Kennedy that was involved in Harriman's partition of Laos, and Kennedy sent the first 16,000 combat troops to Vietnam in the summer of 1963. It all began, and that's when the Americans got involved with combat in Vietnam, 1963. So you see, they can't blame it on Johnson. They know that they started it all, see, without the murder behind it. And without Laos, Ho Chi Minh Trail would not have opened. Without the murder behind it, you would not have had the disaster that you had there. So the establishment has this problem here. They for 8 years leave us a war. No end. And the only answer they had is get out, let it go down the tube. If you get out and go down the tube, they didn't say what happened. And they rejected our military. They said it isn't going to hurt if they get out. And so what happens? So we come in. I said, no, we're not going to do that. I put them on November 3rd. I put them on again during the Cambodia thing. I put them on again last week. I said, no, we're going to stick the course. So they look over here and says, my God. So now, the war that we got the nation into may be ended by the man that they, none of them supported, see, I didn't have any of their support. They never want to see anybody succeed they didn't make. See, I am the only president, see, I never owe them something. I will not, I'm the only president this century that has come out of office without any support for the establishment of significance. Period. Life says they support me. I'm very enthusiastic. Opposed with the Netherlands, opposed with the Collins, opposed with the rest of Dell. I don't care. That's the way that it is. That's it. So really, deep down, just to talk to these people on this, is one, they don't want to see this president do it. But second, there's something else involved. They have a real complex about the war. They got into it. Now they deal with things. And I rather think that it's, you know, it's a terrible thing, but it's kind of like the Spanish Civil War. I would not want to say that those were, I hardly have to be pretty, I mean, that when I read the papers in those days, it's very much on the side of the anti-American people. You know, like most people, how could you be able to But looking back, you know, the divided America, at the present time, there's a strange attitude here. Maybe if the United States fails in Vietnam, then we will withdraw to ourselves, quit these foreign adventures, start cleaning up the ghettos. And of course, we are Israel. But we ain't going to take care of anybody who loses in Vietnam. That's what they fail to realize.
You know, the Israelis know that.
You know, that's why one of my strongest supporters are Rabin and Mrs. Meyer, because they know it, and they are not the fuckers.
I was over there, mate.
Some of your libs here, liberals as we call them, they claim to be friendly, but they let them move on to them in 1 minute. You know that.
It stopped already. Put a Fulbright statement the other day. Yes, it's amazing. And he got away with it, by the way. Imagine had you said something like that.
Mansfield
the same way.
He was the same way. He's a great piece.
That brings up the Middle East itself. When you came in, Dennis Sally, this is one of the great success stories as far as I'm concerned. But I don't believe it. I may be wrong. I may be shooting now, but I know that no one really wants a war over there.
You've been there.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, on the Middle East, I cannot be sanguine about it in terms of negotiating the peace or opening the canal, but I can be reasonably confident in terms of avoiding the reopening. because there just isn't anything in it for either side. For the Israelis, they're just not going to be any. And there isn't enough for the Egyptians, or, may I say, the Russians.
Of course.
Now, the Egyptians aren't going to move unless the Russians want to move. And there's where our Jordan policy came from.
Exactly.
We did in Jordan. See, everything falls into peace. What we did in Jordan, we would not have been successful. If Cambodia were in the background, and what we did in Jordan, of course, it's the word trust that I use to speak to you. This is what it's about. Far more, I mean, far more than a teacher, those 417 million nice people in Vietnam, they're nice English, you know. Far more than their teacher, or the Indonesians who will go, or the Thais that may go, or the Filipinos that will be trapped, or the Japanese that will wait. What is really involved is what happens to trust for the United States abroad, and what happens to the American spirit. That really is on the line. And people say, well, it really doesn't matter if we get out of this war, we just have a sigh of relief and everybody will say, good riddance. This nation's never lost before. Watch. You let them lose. They're gonna like it.
Well, the flag will be in the dirt. And people don't like to see the flag in the dirt. Not even some of our...
Right, and also the main thing, that we don't have to lose. The future of the Pacific, it might be was involved there, but you can leave all that out. Let's say the future of the Pacific is not involved. Let's say it's only the future of the South Vietnamese, and nothing's been done, and so the hell with it out. What's really involved is the future of America, the future of the Mideast, the future of, frankly, because if the American spirit comes out of this war wounded, with a wound from which it cannot recover, then America will not continue to play the role that we have to play if we're going to have a peaceful world, or at the very least a free world in years to come. You know that, everybody. Who the hell else is going to play? The Germans, the Japanese. They're number three and number four in economic power, but emasculated as far as military power. Europe, a couple others who are going to play it, the Russians and the Chinese. There it is. That's the world. We wish it were different, don't we? But it isn't now. See, that's what we Americans, that's what your establishment friends don't want to face up to. They don't want to face up to the fact that we live in a world where what happens here affects the future not only of America, but of the whole world. And so if we drop it, we bug out of Vietnam, we bug out of the world, basically, as far as being world power. That wouldn't be too bad. We don't have to be a world power. We didn't want to be a world power. But on the other hand, it will be a very dangerous world, and would be if the United States of America does not continue to play a strong, vigorous role, not just economically, but in terms of our military diplomatic power. That's what it's about.
We're getting back to that Jordanian crisis, which I think is going to be one of the high points in the book.
Someday. You'll have to get most of that Kissinger.
Yeah, well, I will.
I can tell you much about it.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Well, I'll have to get it. But I was over there at the time.
We were here all the time. I was there.
I know. I was there on the West Bank, and I was got myself accredited to the Army. The Israelis, I thought we'd be moving into Jordan. Was my last fling as.
Were you on the Golden Heights?
Yes, yes. I went to that kibbutz, by the way.
Where I was? Yeah.
Gadol. It's Codot.
Yeah.
And I did deliver your regards, and they were very pleased. And I got a newspaper clipping
great.
In Hebrew, which I can't read.
Right.
But,
you can't.
Well, someday they'll take over the world. Anyway, I was there at that time, and incidentally, these are
touch and go.
These are tough guys.
Let me tell you, the presence of those Israelis on those heights, wouldn't work without any of these.
Yeah. could have been a confrontation, couldn't it?
Well, of course. What would happen if the Libyans had moved in, you know, and knocked over the Jordan and the Jordanian and the invasion and knocked over the Jordanian government? The Israelis could not tolerate that. They would have had to move in. And if the Israelis had moved, the Egyptians would have thought they'd have. So what happens then?
Russians and us.
And we and the Russians then get together.
As a matter of fact, you were highly praised by the chief of Israeli intelligence at that time. I had dinner before I left with him, and his people thought you'd handle it magnificently and kept the whole thing down. But they were, as I gathered, fully prepared to go in. Yes. And it's a problem to hold those guys back. Well, the point is tomorrow.
10 years from now, they can't. That's why they are better advised to make their deal now. Later, they will, too.
I think so.
I think they're smart enough.
They have the internal situation there.
I know it has, but they've got a bargain hard, and they're tough. I understand. But they'd be better off to make their deal now rather than wait.
You know, one of the problems they face, which is interesting politically, they don't know who will be a successor, whether it'll be you or someone else.
Yeah.
And as they put it very bluntly, they don't know who's going to be the big chief in Washington,
yeah,
or whether they can trust a man who, for example, is willing to bug out of American commitments elsewhere,
right,
which is a problem I wish some of our liberal friends would understand. Yeah, and well, they say it. They say it. I don't know if they say it publicly, but they say it privately.
Now, that's the thing that worries them is that they think of anybody who broke up Vietnam might have forgot our commitments.
Well, that's right.
Whatever they may be.
Yeah.
At least even though we have no treaty, the rest of us, shall we say, in a certain position.
Yeah.
We have no treaty in Vietnam.
I know we haven't. I'm just curious. I happen to think that Dr. Kissinger is one of the best guys around.
Right.
I admire him greatly, and I've written about him and so on, and in a column, and what a great guy he is, and so on. I mean, as a person, not as a, you know, as a playboy or anything. You know, as a man, as an advisor, or whatever you call him. How did you discover him?
I knew of him, of course. I never met him, but I knew of him through his book, you know, one of his books. So, those are interesting. I can't remember But then, what happened is that during the campaign, in the last couple of weeks, sent a couple of memoranda through John Mitchell, you know, on the Vietnamese situation. And I know him very good. So after the campaign, I called him into Nanking. And then had a talk with him after we hit it off. Had a talk with him, and then decided to come in with this just like that.
Isn't that amazing?
That's the way it worked.
You know, of course, that he had made, he was, quote, anti-Nixon during the Rockefeller period. Yeah. Which is very interesting.
He's always fight for whoever he works for,
Well, I was, he happens to be one of the more fascinating guys around, and I was just curious how that thing developed. And then checking the log, I did notice he came in, just after the election, over to Pierre. In that Pierre period, were you mainly concerned with getting staff?
Yes, yes. That was the first thing to do, was staff. And cabinet, too, of course. We were getting staff and cabinet. That was practically all of it.
Yes. And what about, and then you assigned task forces and so on. Were they valuable to you, the task force reports?
Yes. Arthur Burns was the main fellow on that. Arthur, before he became head of the Fed, said, gee, we got to get a program. Oh, you know what I mean? Because he remembered my Eisenhower administration. We didn't have a program in the first year. We got the second year. So Arthur set up the task forces. They were extremely valuable in getting our thinking going and some things. And of course, Arthur. duck bucket that Gavin answers on most things. And all the domestic field, he was our primary. That was before we had the domestic council. By that time, we, of course, I had one hand then on the department. This is planning for the future of the Earth Affairs Council. But Arthur Burns was the guy that followed up in some of the areas at that time.
And that eventually became Ellicott's province.
Yeah, then what happened is that we took Moynihan Council, the Economic Council, the Borough Affairs Council, put it all into the Domestic Council.
Mm-hmm.
We all have it there. It has to be. And that's very good. Now we've got three. We've got the Domestic Council, which handles all that. We've got the National Security Council, which, of course, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now we have the International Economic Council, which is policy of Peterson Group, which is extremely important in terms of looking ahead. At this time, we enter a period of military balance. What happens economically to the United States? The continued vitality and growth of the U.S. economy and its ability to compete in the world will determine whether the United States remains the first power in the world. That's one of the reasons why I fought so hard for SST. Let's see how the environmental arms, I suppose. But when a great nation, two reasons. One, a great nation ceases or draws back from exploring a new world or the unknown, whatever the case might be, then it's time for greatness is marked. It's limited. That's the history of nations. Nations that turn in, and I'm not speaking of conquest, I'm not speaking of military conquest, but in exploration, whether it's in science or going to the new worlds, when they turn in, then nations tend then to consume themselves in their own selfishness. So whether it's SST or space or my very strong support of scientific research and now this new commission and economic policy, I want the United States to continue to look outward. We must look outward. Not because we want to dominate the world, but because De Gaulle put it very well when he said, France is only her true self when she is engaged in a great enterprise. And we think of that, too many people, too often, in terms of simply war. War is not what I think of. I reject that in this period of history, world history. But America must continue to be engaged in a great enterprise. Now, there can be great enterprises at home. Cleaning up the air, cleaning up the water, raising our standard of living, seeing that the minorities have a better chance, better education, better health. All these are great enterprises, it's true. But also, but those enterprises are devoted to satisfy our own material needs, our own needs. We cannot, America is a world power because of who we are, where we came from, and where we are. And America, therefore, should play a benevolent role in the world, a dynamic role in the world. Not simply to help other nations, but to help ourselves. Because once we cease to play that role, once we cease to compete with the other great nations, once we cease, that's why I'm for a very liberal trade policy. I don't want barriers around ourselves and just look within. I want us to compete with the rest of the world. I want us to be more productive. I want us to be. You see, that's the vision of the kind of America we want. You know, when the United States says, quit worrying about man on the moon and start worrying about man on Earth, my answer is worry about both. They say, don't build the SST. My question is somebody else going to build it? And it isn't that I'm simply worried about somebody else being number one. We want to keep doing everything. But if there's going to be a new breakthrough in transportation, the United States should be leading that, where we've always been first, rather than waiting up 5, 10 years from now, finding that our plans are obsolete.
Other discouraging episodes, such as the SST going down a drain?
Oh, well, most people will remember the two judges that were turned down. Those were not discouraging. I, as a political realist, knew that with the Democratic House and Senate that we'd be lucky to get anything true. And frankly, we've done rather well. We trust that we're going to be able to get our welfare reform and our revenue sharing hold in part, and maybe a beginning of government reorganization, possibly something to help. But if we can get some of those three, maybe the six tools I set forth in the State of the Union, it will have been a major achievement for this Congress. But in terms of disappointments, the Senate turning down that appointees, it's just part of the game. Now, all you do is fight harder for the next one. That's why we fought hard for Bill Casey.
Yes, our good friend Bill.
Well, what the heck, would you got to let a guy down because he...
Well, I didn't understand the argument.
Well, actually, Bill was probably...
He got how he made his billion a year.
Yeah.
That was a lot. No, well, that's part of the demonstration.
There are disappointments. For example, you would like to have had to stop the inflation center. You would like to have stopped it without any increase in unemployment. There's no way. You'd like to, for example, stop the Vietnam War the day after you came in. We could have, but it was the wrong way. And it would have brought something worse later. These are disappointments. We would have liked to have made more progress in our relations with the Soviet Union. But when do your book close?
Probably late fall.
Oh, you have that much time?
Sure.
Good.
I'll be able to move.
Well, not anything. What may happen, I have no idea.
No.
Something might.
Yeah.
And if it does, you may have another chapter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see.
Watch the Chinese.
Yeah. It's now something now.
Well, that was my initiative. That was not the State Department. That was done under the objection of the State Department.
Why is that?
There was some silly argument about that. It was the State Department trying to get the change of China policy funding. 14 months ago, 18 months ago, I changed the policy. Did for very practical reasons, because I suppose we've got that. But I looked at the facts. I found the reading the Soviet broadcasts and newspapers, the Chinese broadcasts and newspapers. For the Soviet, China was enemy number one. For China, Soviet Union was enemy number one. We were number two in both cases. So what are you doing? You got to realize that if you are going to avoid an impossible situation, a terribly dangerous situation, communist China with billions of people completely isolated. The Soviet isn't going to be able to crush that. Maybe we have to. Now you can't do it immediately. This is the time. And if you tried it immediately, it wouldn't work for such so little of trade, travel, these little good sweet announcements we made.
Uh-huh.
Purpose was to sort of show that the door was open. Not for recognition and admission to the UN, this is not China. But, because we have our commitment to Taiwan, we will keep it. But on the other hand, if we look at the world, and I tend to look ahead 25 years rather than 5, 2, if we look at the world 25 years ahead now, I want to be sure that I have done everything that I can to make the world safer then. Safe then, and not just now. And we're 25 years from now, the communist China sitting out there with the Soviet Union and the United States. I said, it would be a terribly dangerous world. So, it's a shock. Why here in the state, the tradition said, look, they want to recognize China years ago, very frustrated. But now, the Russians, you see, were selected in China, stay opposed to because they want to make the Russians mad. So I said, now look, we're not doing this to make the Russians mad. We're doing it because we want good relations with both, or as good as we can have. So I did it over state suggestions. Every move that I made on China has been my own.
That is fascinating.
But it's a little blip. But watch.
Well, it's very funny because curiously enough, I was happy when he brought in the ping pong players. For a lot of reasons. I know what we did to the Russians, so I don't give a damn.
That's what worries the state departments. You see, their concern is that they want to become the Russians. So do we. But you see, my view is the way to get it is not to.
Are you getting any? Are you getting flack from Taiwan?
I talked to the foreigners today when he left. Yes, but they know that I'm their friend, and also they know that they're up against an increasingly difficult situation. And by the fall, you will know whether their position has changed in the UN. You see, they may not be able to. We may not be able to. I'm not getting in, I'm not changing the position. My position will be the same. But you've got to fall, so...
No.
Don't close anything in this chapter. Let me say it will fall the latest possible time.
I want to keep it open. Let me put it this way, Mr. President. Number one, there will be nothing in his book that will be embarrassing.
Oh, I know.
That's number two. Whenever you feel like, if you have any, get any ideas in the next few weeks, next few months, send them along. I'll put it in a book. In many ways, this may work. It's completely unofficial. I'm fully responsible. But I think it might be a valuable weapon.
Right.
I think the book might be. Now, let me ask you one other question about young people. Has this been a major problem for you?
Yeah, and understand them. I mean, basically, the young people frankly, it's a problem we inherited.
That's right.
It's a problem we inherited. Look, the young people they're turned off, but not just for the war. They're turned off of the system. They're turned off of the fact that their professors and, frankly, just the high school students, their teachers, have been turned off, too, you see. And so they look at these systems, and so it's the war, it's the ecology, and everything else, and they say, gee. And it's an indication of the fact. It isn't just us. It's around the world. Young people in every industrial country are turned off. Now, I would say, what is going to change them? No speeches to young people. No rap sessions with young people. I rap. I mean, I talk to them. I will talk to them. I've been to universities and so forth and so on, as you know. And they like to hear that. But what will change them? Is frankly success. If we succeed in ending the war, if we succeed in showing that this economy still is a pretty good thing, and also as they realize as time goes on that this isn't too bad a country, that's part of the problem. If only they could move around. If only they could know, good God, I've been to every country in the world except communist China, virtually every country. And, you know any other place you'd rather live? Or that you'd rather be born? Whether you were black, white, anything? Huh? Agreed?
I agree.
That's the point. Now, that's old hat stuff these days.
It is. You know, they don't buy it.
They don't buy it, and I don't try to sell them.
Yeah.
But my point is, once the war problem is back at them and they're not worried about a draft and they can't yell peace now, and once they say, well, we've got an ecology program, you realize what it forces them to do? It forces them to do something their teachers have done a kind of great service to. It forces them then to turn to themselves and say, now wait, it was the war that was to blame. It was the dirty air, the dirty water. It's the system. And so always gets back fundamentally to the problem of the spirit, the individual spirit. That's all. And it is going to be solved only by that. It isn't going to be solved by preaching to them. It isn't going to be solved by patriotic speeches. It isn't going to be solved by dialogue. It will be solved only as excuses for being against the system are withdrawn. And then finally the individual has to look in that mirror one day and he says, gee, maybe I ought to look. Maybe the fault is, that's what they never hear in their schools. Self-reliance, follow what you want.
Yes. How does the political thing look to you now, Mr. Cliff?
I'm not sure what to say. You mean as to what our Democratic Party?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I think that the Laotian thing had one beneficial look.
Yeah, well,
this would be in your book, but not in the talk. And I'll start like they I can attend it that way if it was for them. The greatest mistake you can make in politics is to strike a kid without killing him. And also by, in this case, by striking two of them. Now what they did, they talked about that's this year's issue. And they all get out and here. Muskie's even endorsed this, these demonstrations. All right. So they're all taking this on. Now, they didn't have to. If I had been giving advice politically, I would have said, wait a minute, boys. You've got this guy right where you want him. Because it's a pity. If he fails, you can blame him. But if he succeeds, and you have criticized him, he'll blame you. See? That's the position they're now in. They took a risk they didn't have to take. So our war issue, the other issue is the economic issue. He didn't want to be put on the next year either. So I think as I look at it, I am not concerned about the present. The year itself, the issues of the spring are not the ones of the fall. This is the spring of 71.
Yeah, yeah.
By next fall,
they're all out there.
All of that
is running crazy. They're out there. Like,
they're all out screaming about they're screaming about the war, they're screaming about getting out, they're screaming about and there's also something a little bit they're responsible. Now, let's suppose we do a couple of things. Let's see what the Secretary says.
Well, it's my lawyer. It's my law firm.
Hey, what? Did you get my counsel's papers?
I just want to say
that. Okay. Just keep your. I think the guy that frankly is really close to the
Musk.
I don't know. Don't you just keep his mouth? He's a nice looking man. Everybody thought he was like Lincoln. Now he opened his mouth. Wearing well, dinner like you
can. Wearing dinner with a fellow named Templeman who's George McGillan's money boy.
Oh, good.
Wednesday.
And I keep encouraging him. Go ahead.
Give him a kiss.
Well,
the other one is Teddy, of course, he's on coming up hard.
Hubert. I would say it's Hubert.
Hubert's not shut.
But he went on one of these talk shows and was telling about how he always opposed the war.
Well, now, really, it sounded ridiculous.
It sounded different.
It sounded all. Let me say, I appreciate your comments, right? Because you had a lot of guts. But you're going to prove me right. I never made it. I'm not working on it. It's a funny thing about the war is a terribly difficult and old. They'll take us on another issue. But, you know, like when we, like when I went on last week, on You ever read Carl Sandburg, The Darkest Month of the Civil War? You know when it was? August of 1964. And in September, it was all virtually over because of Sherman marched through Georgia. But that was about it. My point is that right at the present time, everybody's worried about the damn thing. It's like Rogers should have gone through, but they said he got to announce a bigger withdrawal and the rest of them. I said, that would. We're not going to come all this way and just show it out with an announcement. So we just stick it in there firm. And you know, it even more our side cases, I think they got a little respect for this standing up to them.
Well, you stood up for them, and I'll tell you something, Mr. President. The truth of the matter is, it's the only thing you can do. Being honest with yourself and honest with the country. You can't let these pressures and public opinion boards get.
They would love for you to.
Look, I'm sure that if you went on a poop tube right now and said, I'm taking that and getting everybody home, no more, but out of the world, everybody will cheer you and you lose next year.
Okay, thank you.